Continue now here as we dive into the exposition of this. Verses 2 through 5, at the harvest time, he sent a slave to the vine growers in order to receive some of the produce of the vineyard along with the vine growers. They took him and beat him and sent him away empty-handed. And he sent another slave, and they wounded him in the head and treated him shamefully. And he sent another one, and that one they killed. And so with many others, beating some on the one hand, and on the other hand, killing others, or murdering them. So point one here, the parabolic teaching continues just as one might expect. The normal relationship between a landlord and a tenant farmer would require the landowner to make a provision to receive the agreed upon portion of the harvest. Two, there were generally three types of leases in Israel at that time. The first one was one in which the tenants received a certain portion of the fruits, perhaps a third or fourth of the produce. And in this case, it was sometimes the practice to give them a portion of the produce to also provide the seed for next year's field and to pay wages to the laborers. For the second type of lease is more familiar to the modern reader and simply involved the payment of a definite sum of money, rent, to the landowner. And the third type of lease involved an agreement between the owner and the tenant that the owner was to receive a definite amount of the produce. And this is clearly the type of situation that is set forth in our parable. The one we have here is that the landowner is to receive a particular segment of a portion of the produce. So, 6, according to Leviticus, when the Jews entered into Canaan, the fruit of any tree or vineyard was forbidden for use from 3 years. And in the fourth year, they could use the fruit for various offerings, and they could eat from it in the fifth year. That's Leviticus 19:23. When you enter the land and you plant all kinds of trees for food, then you shall count their fruit as forbidden. 3 years it shall be forbidden to you, it shall not be eaten, but in the fourth year all its fruit will be holy, an offering of praise to the Lord. And in the fifth year, you are to eat of its fruit, that its yield may increase for you. I am the Lord your God. So, 7, and of course, some of that had to do with the particulars of going into Canaan and some doctrinal lessons that were being taught. But generally speaking, most of these farming operations didn't really produce fruit and didn't really become successful to the point where you could profit from it for 4 to 5 years. So the phrase, at the harvest time, reflects the Greek noun kairos, which refers to a specific time and appropriate or fit season. And in this case, it refers to the harvest that occurred some 4 to 5 years after their initial tenancy. Now Matthew 21:34 calls it the time of the fruits, whereas Mark uses a more generic term, just a strategic time, a fit time, which is the harvest. Matthew 21:34. When the harvest time approached, well, what you don't see in it's not reflected in the New American Standard, but the Greek reads the time of the fruits in Matthew. So by interpretation, point 8, the delay leading to the time of the harvest represents that time again that God allows believers to grow to the point where they become fruitful. Again, we don't expect new believers to come in and immediately begin making strong applications and understanding of divine good because they don't possess it. Now, that's not to say that a person, and I've seen believers who were really positive and gung-ho, and they came in and they began to run circles around people who'd been there for years. They were applying doctrine at a much higher level, unfortunately. Overtly, you could see it. So, again, we allow people the time and the space to grow up, recognizing that things don't happen overnight, nor does God expect instant overnight success. And this is the problem, again, with our microwave culture. Everybody wants it now. I want to be a mature believer, and I want it now. Okay, how's that working for you? Have you made it yet? It doesn't happen overnight. It requires time and grade, running the race, learning, failing, stumbling, falling on your face, getting up, making mistakes, learning from them, and all of this. It's not, I think I'd like to tell you, the Christian life is going to be a nice, smooth ride where you'll just grow and it'll be wonderful, but it won't be. That's just not realistic. You're gonna fail. You're gonna come short. You're gonna make huge mistakes. You're gonna make great successes. You'll have, you know, you'll experience everything emotionally, from the highest of the highest to the lowest of the lows, if you're living the Christian life properly. God does not exempt believers from all these things, from suffering, from spiritual growth, and these other factors. So, however, point nine here, what must happen during that time was generally not happening over the course of Israel's history. The religious and political leaders who should have been teaching and enforcing the principles of God's plan were failing under their own negative volition. And 10, had the religious leaders been doing as they should have, there would have been a point at which the nation would have been producing acceptable levels of divine good. But guess what? We never got there. And ultimately, that leaves a nation in trouble with God and ultimately in standing of judgment, that God will eventually intervene in the situation in a negative way. So 11, at the appropriate time, the landowner delegates his authority to a particular slave who is to travel to the vineyard, receive his master's portion, and return it to him. And 12, although the one sent was a slave, doulos, and had no standing or authority of his own, it does not mean that he should be ignored. And in fact, the slave of a rich landowner could also be a person of some consequence. And my suspicion is his first person he sent was his most trusted slave, the one whom he thought would get the job done. And again, we may be four, and this partially explains these people's behavior, because we may be 4 to 5 years down the road from the time they initially took tenancy. Some time has passed, probably at least 3 years, and again, if not 4 or 5. So who would, if you were a wealthy landowner, who would you send? I would send my most trusted slave. That's who I would send. And the guy that, most reflected my views and understood what I wanted and was there to look out for my interests. I mean, if I was a landowner, that's what I would do. So again, it's not just because, so when you read slave here, don't presume that this was just some lowly guy who didn't have any demeanor or bearing that the people should have respected. He could have very well been very respectable. The fact that he's a slave is not a mark against him here. So 13, what is clear is that the tenants were to fulfill their part of the bargain, respect the delegate sent to them, and send the master's portion with the slave. However, during the intervening years, the tenants, we presume here, had no contact with the landowner, and that was very often the case in the case of an absentee landowner. There wouldn't necessarily be any contact because the landowner's not really looking for anything for the first few years. He recognizes, and I think it's still true today, that they say if you start a business of some sort, plan on not making a profit before your third year. That if you make a profit any time before that, you've done well. So, and the same thing is true here, sort of in the growing of the grapes and preparing of all of that, that you have to have, and you'll still see it today, like if you shop for wine very often, and you do it with any, in-depth research, what you will hear are things like old growth vines. And vines that have been planted and are in the same soil, and all of this, the French, it has a particular climate and a particular soil content, a particular moisture factor, a particular heat factor and cool factor. All these things are called terroir. And so each place has like its own terroir. And so when you have new vines, they don't produce great grapes. But if you get into the 92, 94, 98 point wines, number one, they're going to be expensive. They're not going to be cheap. But number two, very often you'll find these are vines that have been planted for 80, 90, 100 years. And one of the things that they have, in particular, you saw it with the sort of growth of the California and the Western Coast wine markets, is that they would bring cuttings from France for the things that they were wanting to grow. Older vines, and use those and plant those. And so you have this point where for 2, 3, 4 years, okay, no big deal. There's no point in being in contact with them. I'm not expecting any fruit yet. Not any that I want. I mean, the landowner, yeah, maybe they got some fruit the first year, but it wouldn't have been much, and it wouldn't have been quality, frankly. And not the kind of quality you would get later on as you went down the road. So, again, however, during the intervening years, the tenants had no contact with the landowner, who apparently did not concern himself with what was happening on the property. The landowner presumes that these are normal human beings who will fulfill their obligations and adhere to the contract which they've drawn up. And he's not expecting any trouble. Now, some can say, well, that's short-sighted, but I don't think it's short-sighted. I think he had a reasonable expectation that these people should do what they said they would do and provide for him what is his. Well, 15, this is where the analogy breaks down, since God, the absentee landowner, is always cognizant of every development taking place in his plan. Isaiah 46, 9 and 10. And this is one of the things we have to, when we're dealing with parabolic teaching, we'll have to point to you that all analogies break down at a point. No analogy is perfect. And so we can say God is, the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner. Well, yeah, it's like that, but it's not exactly like that. And it will break down, all analogies will break down at some point. The key is figuring, interpretatively, where the analogies break down. See, the absentee landowner really didn't see, hear, or in some ways even care about what was going on in that vineyard, because he presumed that these were honorable people. Well, God obviously monitors all things that are happening in his vineyard, in his plan. Isaiah 46, 9 and 10. Whoops, that's the wrong one. Remember the former things long past, for I am God and there is no other. I am the Lord, and there is no one like me, declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times things which have not been done. So God not only has a cognizance of what's unfolding in history at any given moment, God knew what precipitated it, God knows where it's headed, God is in some way supra-temporal, He can be in the moment, as it were, and see exactly what's happening, but He knows the end from the beginning. He knows what started it, He knows how it's going to go, and He knows how it's going to end. Saying, my purpose will be established and I will accomplish all of my good pleasure. So basically, if you had God as being a real, if the analogy doesn't break down here, essentially then we would be deists. And deists are largely people, part of their theology, and this was largely our founding fathers, by the way. They believe that God, yeah, He created the world and all of that, and got everything started, but then He kind of stepped away because He had other stuff to do. And so He just leaves this and He doesn't intervene in any way. He lets people run their deal and do their thing, and He in no way cares. Or if He cares, we don't know that He cares, because He won't intervene or show Himself or make His will plain. Well, that's what deists believe, that God sort of steps away from it all. Well, we don't. That's where the analogy breaks down. We're not deists. So, 16, nevertheless, the tenants had become accustomed to treating the vineyard as if it was their own, and determined that they were not going to share the produce with the landowner as they previously agreed to do. 17, this makes it explicit that these men have become entrenched in their position, thinking that they were secure even if they violated the terms of the contract. And so, again, you try to get into why would they think this? I mean, the force, if he's a wealthy, which we presume he would be with all the improvements, the capital improvements he put into this thing, if he's a wealthy landowner, they've got to believe that the force of law is probably going to be on his side, just as typically, unfortunately, sadly, you know, the law favors the wealthy because they can, again, buy whatever they need in that sense. So why would they think like this? Well, again, it's hard to get into their thinking because they're in the wrong. And I don't necessarily want to know everything about it, but we'll deal with it. So therefore, point 18, one cannot take the position that these men were simply misguided, ill-informed, or unable to abide by the terms of the contract. One must recognize that this behavior demonstrates that these men are evil, rebellious, obstinate, and ultimately violent. And that's what they really are. And so, 19, their treatment of the slaves, which will grow progressively worse, is a clear repudiation of the owner's rights under the contract. They essentially now challenge the owner to enforce the terms, if he thinks he can. And essentially, here's what's happening in the bigger picture with Jesus and the religious leaders, is that they essentially have adopted this sort of attitude of God cannot enforce His will on us any longer. We are now the rulers of the vineyard. We run this operation. And we're not going to respect these people that are sent to us. So they rejected John the Baptist. And they rejected Jesus. And ultimately, as we're going to see under the analogy here, they kill Him as well. So again, these guys just basically, I mean seriously, they're throwing down the gauntlet to the owner saying, enforce this if you think you can. We don't think you can. And we're going to do it our way. And that very much reflects the religious leadership of Israel at that time. No concern for the divine good production of the people. No concern for teaching sound doctrine. No concern for anything other than themselves. And that's what gets into with these religious leaders. They're not there any longer serving the sheep. They're serving themselves. And the sheep are suffering under this regime. Because they're not being fed, they're not being cared for, and in many cases they're being exploited. We had that coming up there at the end. If you look at the end of Mark 12, there's a situation, and it's an interesting passage, and I won't get into it much today. But when he's sitting in the treasury watching how people were putting money into the treasury, in verse 41, and how many rich people were putting in large sums of money. And a poor widow came and put in 2 copper coins, which amounts to a cent. Well, one question is, did God ever tell anybody to throw all their money into the offering plate? I don't think He did, but if He did, that's how I'm teaching it. All right, give till it hurts. No, give it all. Well, I mean, and literally, some people, and this very much is analogous to what we have today in our culture, of these televangelists and their goofy stuff, and they're exploiting these segments of society who are least able to afford this. The dumb people who will sit there and send them their money to get the miracle prayer cloth. And if you put this prayer cloth in your wallet, money will magically appear. And gullible believers out there buy into this. In many cases, they're the less educated believers, the less wealthy believers. They're people who do not think critically. I mean, really, I'll give you my Kleenex, and here's your magic prayer cloth. It's my glass cleaner. So, you can... $50. Who's got $50 for the magic prayer cloth? And they abuse people like this. Well, that's what this system is doing. Like you see this poor widow, she's suffering under this system. And whether Jesus is commending her or not, that's an interesting question. As you get into the passage, and we'll deal with that more as we get into it. On the one hand, Jesus commends her for her gift. On the other hand, I can't find any verse in the Bible that tells me to bankrupt myself. And she essentially bankrupted herself. And so I've already looked at some of the very creative interpretations of this. And the widow's a believer. She's exercising great faith rest. And God's for all this. And blah, blah, blah. Even if she doesn't have another meal, she doesn't care. Well, where in the Bible did God tell us to do that? So is this really a commendation of the widow, or is this also a condemnation of the system that he's talking about? And I think it's both. I think it's vague. I think it's intentionally vague here because I think it's both. I think both things are true. Well, so they essentially challenge God, as it were, in the analogy and say, if you think you can do anything, try it. Well, I wouldn't take that position with God if you think you can do anything. Well, 20, there is an element of the Greek that is not necessarily reflected in the English translation that indicates that the landowner was not seeking to exploit the tenants. So any argument of this, and again, there was, just as is there in this country today, and probably in every society that's ever existed, I suppose, this sort of class warfare that goes on. Sometimes it's better, sometimes it's worse, but sometimes it's more noticeable, but the poor tend to resent the rich. And, they should pay more in taxes. Why? Just because they're rich? Are we going to start segregating pieces of the society and say, okay, well, this segment has to pay more, these people can pay less? And it all sounds good on the surface. But in Israel, very often when you look at these offerings, these mandated things like the tithe, God didn't say the rich people pay 20% and the poor people pay 10%. Tithe means 10. So it didn't matter whether you're rich or poor, you paid the same flat tax, 10%. And any other offerings, the redemption of the firstborn. The rich didn't pay more and the poor didn't pay less. It was whatever it was, a half a shekel or whatever that the deal was on that. But it was the same for everybody. So trying to, but guess what? Those positions, people in positions of power and leadership, politically and here religiously, use this to play the classes against each other, and nobody ever notices that the politicians sitting at the top of this thing are just getting fatter and fatter and fatter. They got free haircuts, free health care, free everything you and I would want, but we can't yet. They vote on their own raises. I love that. I'm going to go to work Monday and tell my boss, let's vote on my raise. And I get the only vote. Well, I don't think he's going to go for it. I mean, but that's what we have here. Well, so the conjunction Hina here, but they're not trying to exploit the tenants. He's only asking what's legitimately his. While people might look at it and say, oh, well, that wealthy landowner, he didn't need any more. He had enough. Well, who are you to make that call? What if God was blessing him? Now you're going to take the position that the wealthy landowner under the blessing of God is evil somehow. I don't think so. And of course, in the parable, in the analogy here, he represents God. I don't want to say that he's evil for what he's doing. That stretches the interpretation to me. Well, 21, the conjunction hina, in order that or so that, that you find there, let me see where I'm at here exactly in the verse. In order that, that's verse 2. In order to receive some of the produce, introduces a purpose clause, but the phrase from the vine growers is placed forward in the clause for emphasis. In 22, the phrase uses the preposition para, from or with, which has the force of along with the vine growers. And this indicates he was not seeking to take any advantage of these tenants, but only intended to receive his portion when they receive theirs. He's not saying, I got to get mine first. He's saying, as you get yours, I get mine. Now that's a very enlightened attitude, I think, and very fair by every, meaning of the word fair. It's not as though he's saying, I get mine first and you just get what's left. It's I'll get mine along with you. And that, to me, is all, I don't know what more you would ask of the landowner. Well, 23, there's no indication of deception of any kind, and no indication the landowner sought anything in excess of the agreement, or that he was not willing to even give them their share first. You get your share, and I'll take mine alongside with it. That's as generous as you can be, I think. So here, everything in this says the landowner essentially bends over backwards for these people. And guess what? That's not enough for some people. When you get into negative volition, you can't hold your face right in front of them. They'll find some problem with it. And you can bend over backwards and try to get them to come around, but if they're not going to come around, they're not going to come around. And you see here, the landowner is very, very nice. He's a very good landowner. He's a very good leasor. He handles this very professionally. He makes all these capital improvements. I mean, he's done everything he can do and even gone what I would call above and beyond what he had to do. I mean, he didn't have to do all that stuff. But he set up a quality operation and gave them everything they needed. Well, in fact, all this parable will implicitly affirm the righteousness of the landowner, who is seen to be upright in terms of the agreement, is patient, and does not engage in retaliation, even when he is unjustly provoked and in the right. Now, how many people you know like that? I have trouble, getting over somebody cutting me off on the interstate. And here the landowner is going to put up with the murder of his slaves, essentially the tenants thumbing their nose at him and doing whatever they feel like doing, and that is not the way this is supposed to go, obviously. But the landowner is seen all through this whole thing as doing nothing other than what is perfectly right and just and normal. Just as God with his nation never did anything other than what was needed. Well, 25, this is designed to portray the goodness and patience of God, who gave Israel numerous opportunities to orient to his plan and produce the fruit that he was seeking. And 26, verse 3 introduces a violent turn into the story as the delegate of the landowner is physically assaulted, beaten, and sent away empty-handed. And that's certainly a step up from what they did to the first guy. The first guy got all kind of light, we might say. The slave represents a prophet here whom God had sent to Israel at various times in his history. And actually, I think this is the first one. The first one actually got off easy because they only beat him. They start killing the others. But the treatment grows progressively worse. The more they get away with this, the more emboldened they are to continue their path. And this is one of the things I found with negative volition. Just cut them off at the pockets. You haven't got anything to lose, believe me. They're only going to get worse. And I've seen it played out time and time again, just in my short course of history here on planet Earth, that when people begin to get away with this type of behavior, you just got to, you know, people say, well, you run a really tight ship and you don't put up with any nonsense. You betcha, we do, and we're not going to. Because I've put up with nonsense in the past, and you know how it worked out? Not well. And I've seen other pastors put up with nonsense, and it doesn't work out. But we want to be gracious. We want to give everybody every chance we can to orient, but there comes a point at which you've just got to face facts. And at some point, as we know here, this landowner is just going to have to face the facts. And does God want to jam his people? Does he want to kill them? Does he want to judge them? No. No. No more than the pastor wants to do anything like that to the congregation. He wants them to make it spiritually. Just as God wants these people to make it and be successful in Israel. So the slave here represents a prophet whom God sent to Israel at various times in its history to get the nation back on track spiritually. And since we have a lot of verses there, I'm just going to go ahead and stop there today. And we will pick up here on Tuesday and see how nice they were to the prophets. Not very nice, as we'll find out. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the privilege of studying your word. We thank you for all the grace you provide so that we can continue to advance spiritually, and pray that you would sanctify this to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.